Dorothy Chan. My name is Jamie Ringlab. I had this idea where I was going to give an introduction that was essentially a collection of details about Dorothy Chan that were completely untrue. Here are some examples. Dorothy Chan's favorite question to be asked, especially by total strangers, is why do you write poetry? Dorothy Chan believes that conservative dress is the single indication of an interesting person. Asking Dorothy Chan questions about Chinese culture, especially Chinese food culture, is the best way to spark her interest in you. But if you'd like to take it a step further and you want Dorothy Chan to totally fall in love with you, hold the door open for her any chance you get and buy her drinks and meals and drinks and meals and drinks because you are a man and that's what men do. Finally, Dorothy Chan fucking hates art. Fuck art, art is fucking stupid. I don't know why I thought of writing an introduction like this, but I pitched the idea to Dorothy Chan, partially because I knew it was stupid, and Dorothy Chan had a very Dorothy Chan response. Why? I'm getting to a point, but go with me a little bit further. When Dorothy Chan says something, she does so with a sometimes alarming sense of authority. Here's an example. Once Dorothy said, speaking about a thematic interest in her poems, capitalism is fascinating, you know. I love capitalism. And for the next 6 or so hours, I truly thought capitalism, which I've had very mixed feelings about ever since business school, was the absolute shit. I could take that further if I have to. To me, in those 6 hours, the world did not matter without capitalism. Neruda did not love love as much as I love capitalism. Sylvia Plath did not love bees or uncomfortable World War II references as much as I loved capitalism. Robert Frost did not love himself as I much loved capitalism. The only person who loved capitalism more than I did in those 6 hours was Donald fucking Trump. Now, my susceptibility to brainwashing and other types of thought reform aside, I take this to mean two things. The thing one is that Dorothy Chan would make a successful cult leader. The thing two is that she is uniquely captivating, and this, in turn, makes her singular and a singularly powerful poet. In a recent workshop, Dorothy Chan was asked to define the voice of her poems. Her response, the alpha female. I think this is particularly true in her centerfold poems, persona poems, about a number of women who revel in and trouble the male gaze. These women demonstrate a willful mastery of their own objectification. It is something they own, their bodies, their sexuality, their power, their love, their lovers. When these women say, in reference to their boyfriends, my man, they mean it. They believe their beholders are their possessors. And yet Dorothy's portraiture of these personas isn't so simple a reversal. There is a meticulous complexity behind the poems, which leaves these personas open to inhabit with a wild, fiery grace, the sometimes difficult space between liberation and self-deception. The poems ask, do these women love freely, or have they bought into the narrative of love? Are they themselves, as centerfolds, in some way a part of this consumable narrative? Dorothy's work is political work. She has categorized she's categorized her most recent poems as Paris, Hong Kong poems, poems that question the commercial landscape of Hong Kong in terms of its westernization, sexism, and homophobia. As a result, her observations here are manifold. Prostitutes, Tom of Finland, Western architecture, Western film, and sexy expats bustle through these poems, seen by the speaker both as prominent and suppressed elements of a larger, fluctuating culture. This, I think, is part of Dorothy's obsession, the questioning of popular icons and archetypes that emerge from and become representative of multinational societies in shift. Her Chinatown from the movie Sonnets, for example, investigate various landscapes of various Chinatowns, from Philadelphia to New York City, from Singapore to Roman Polanski's Chinatown. And yet, despite all this complexity of landscape, culture, and psychology, what fascinates me most about Dorothy's poetry is the way the poems pressure, advance, and sometimes destabilize our expectations of craft. Her forceful rhythms, her efficiency of image and illusion, her fluctuating use of persona, her wild, complex syntax, and her play and form all work together to contribute to a body of work as multifaceted as those bodies, landscapes, and psychologies she investigates. And the voice behind these investigations is, as I've said, a uniquely captivating one. The voice behind a Dorothy Chan poem is not a quiet force. It is torrential and thunderous. Dorothy was a semi-finalist for the 2015 Yes Books Open Reading Period. She was a 2014 finalist for the Ruth Lilly and Dorothy Sargent Rose Burke Poetry Fellowship. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in Blackbird, Plume, Spillway, Day One, Ghost Ocean, Connotation Press, and the Great American Poetry Show. In 2012, The Writing Disorder nominated her poem, Bukuro Train Rides, for a pushcart. I'd like to invite you now to drink the punch. Ladies and gents, Dorothy Chan.
Thank you so much for coming tonight, and Jamie, thank you again for that amazing introduction. I'm going to start with a few poems that come from my latest series called Paris, Hong Kong. And this series plays a lot with the influence of Western, particularly European culture in places such as Hong Kong and certain provinces in China. And I remember this article I read on Vice and Huffington Post, actually, that was about the fake Eiffel Tower, or the replica Eiffel Tower in China. And that kind of sparked my interest. And I started reading more and more articles about Western-influenced architecture in China. One example was this billionaire Chinese man went to Paris. He fell in love with a chateau, and he had so much money that he was able to get his team of architects and engineers to replicate this chateau, and now it's a hotel. And I think that things like this are just really amazing and very postmodern, and this is a theme that has kind of pervaded my work throughout. So this first poem is called Paris, Hong Kong, a city overlooking the 18th century. I'm walking on Pedder Street with my fashionista aunt when her bedazzled finger points at the homoerotic painting that fills the preppy storefront top to bottom. Both of them beautiful, their well-oiled bodies perfect. We see a bottom with his top. The catcher sports his sailor hat worshiping his captain, the muscled pitcher holding erect the stars and stripes because it's their revolution we live in, this Tom of Finland couple, Delacroix asking their patriotic, boy on boy, boy oh boy, let's conquer this land, a giant whiff of cologne scented on their bodies, lovesick puppy beefcakes plastered in the storefront in the Beaux-Arts district, stuck in 18th century Europe, central Hong Kong, because hot expats hang around here in pubs eating fish and chips and tapas in the capital of dim sum, because down the street, a Korean hooker is trying on teacup dresses and top hat headbands curtsying to our Australian dandy. But really, it's 18th century America, boys love. How do the Cantonese shoppers just plow through white-collared shirts, Midwestern boy gear, things that frat boys in America wear? The captain looks down, marking his territory, eyes all over his handsome lover. Like in Sunset Boulevard when Joe walks into Norma's, telling her that her young Gloria Swanson days are over. She needs a Valentino, not some gigolo Joe Schmo Hollywood, to make love to on the floor of her grand bowling alley as her gorgeous portraits stare back, photo stacked on photo stacked on photo, watching. This is the progression of her life stilted. Her yesteryear sleeping in a Swan's bed, vintage cars mad about the boy's cigarette case, Hollywood heyday drama of why do you keep calling about the car? The spotlight shifts from her, old Hollywood hooray now lost. I stare at the sex positions with Tom of Finland-esque on display, the Cantonese losing it with the Americana on polos, but I feel like buying a scented fan, holding it to my face as I seduce an expat who's eating wings at the British joint. Going back to his place, then plopping that well-oiled body's painting in the middle of his living room as we make love. The music of the 18th century, some quartet of violas, like we're in a cottage in a Rococo painting as shoppers walk past. And this is called San Diego Hotel, the 80s whirlpool of my mother's childhood. It's the second poem in the series so far. And I'm still kind of revising it, so please bear with me. I'm walking with my mother around Kowloon when we see it, the San Diego Hotel, its gold letters atop black marble, Porsches and Bentleys out front. I think it's swanky, but my mother tells me that hookers frequented the hotel back in the 80s. Late night when worried parents waited for their children outside apartments sitting on doorsteps. And on the hotel side, a faded sign. A woman with her hair up in a jacuzzi stares at me. She's from the Scarface era, snorting cocaine in hot tubs. The era of bubbles in your face, bubbles in your glass, bubbles over the replica Roman statue in your bathroom, along with the five Greek ones. As you dial your gilded rotary phone, it's a time of blue backless dresses worn at bars filled with mirrors where you order milk because you're tired of champagne and sushi. The hot tub woman's image is now faded into a blue-green. It's no longer my mother's Hong Kong of the 80s, the Hong Kong of family stores selling tea and medicine, of dessert shops across the street where hookers with their men meet in the seedy after hours of dessert after the dessert after the dessert. I'm at a pork stand looking at the women across the street. Their breasts are spilling out some tight red fabric as they hand out beer flyers, gesturing to the tight staircase where one man's already waiting. I think of how blatant it all is. The, let's get the job done and I'm not treating you to ice cream or a second visit later. A woman walks up in stilettos, another one takes her place, nearly identical. Up the tight staircases she goes. And later, up the tight staircases I go, back to my aunt's home, entering doors modeled after Chinese dungeons. As I turn on the TV, catch up on America, where back in LA, limos parked outside, 25 men are entering a mansion, ready to choose a potential bride-to-be. Two women, it's either rational and funny or emotional and beautiful. The women aren't holding beer flyers, but their eyes say it all. Pick me and I won't leave you at the altar like she will. Pick me and we'll bask in a hot tub, cameras in our faces, followed by a trip in a helicopter over the Grand Canyon, then Mount Rushmore, then over some waterfall, and then Paris. Followed by an overnight date, rose petals on the bed. The men start the cocktail party, clinking their beer glasses, flocking towards emotional and beautiful. Rational and funny cries, tears of decadence in the corner. And I think that this question of, like, I like to ask people this question a lot. If you were given the choice to date or make love to either someone who's emotional and beautiful or rational and funny, you know, and you have to pick one. Actually, in the audience, who would go with emotional and beautiful? And then I'm assuming, like, everyone else is rational and funny, right? I mean, ideally, you want a combination of both, but I just like to put people into this little, like, trouble spot, you know? I mean, I know emotional and beautiful would be, like, a total train wreck, but I'd like to say that those people are a lot more complex. You know, like, rational and funny, that's kind of it's a defense mechanism. And it's not that the emotional and beautiful one can't be funny or rational, but that's the standout characteristic. And it's also not like the rational, funny one isn't beautiful. It's not like she's ugly or he's ugly. That's just not the most standout characteristic. Yeah, good job, Nettie. Now I'm going to read a couple random poems from my Chinatown from the Movies manuscript. And this is from the section, this is such a pervasive theme, but this is from the section called Paris, China, Paris, Japan. And as Jamie was saying in my introduction, Roman Polanski's 1974 Chinatown is one of my all-time favorite films. It's a huge influence in my work, and I just kind of like to juxtapose the beauty and the film noir aspect of that movie with current and hip Hong Kong, Japan culture. Paris, China, Paris, Japan. And this is number 33 in the manuscript. We'll always have Paris, Casablanca, 1942. Faye's silk mask, Jack's deep scar. American couples mimic their lovemaking sesh because the lanterns light up in sex scenarios. Orientalism of hookah and cookies dropped. But the Japanese couple wants Rose of Versailles sexed up, Marie Antoinette roses in your hair in a cottage overlooking the 18th century, when in reality they're entering our century and the gritty France. So the woman gets Paris syndrome since they can't talk to locals, since they can't concentrate on residue romanticism. They return home sad, the Japanese government has to fix them. The Paris obsession travels to China too, the Eiffel Tower and Tian Duchang. I bought our anniversary tickets to Paris, a husband tells his wife over sushi. She beams, thinking it's Paris, Paris, France. Paris, China, that is, he corrects. The wife now wants to throw up her feelings in raw fish. It's the real thing, I guess. 34. Attractive girls in Hong Kong are also known as girl gods. Besides their striking beauty, girl gods are known for their big eyes, which enhance their image. 34. Oh well, close enough. The Chinese-American TV host tapes monolids over her eyes, now expanded temporarily. She's purposely wearing the big-eyed French KDT while telling the audience, girls, don't try this at home, when you know she's tried it too many times to tell. She wants to educate Asian girls on appreciating their eyes, their exoticism, but the to-don'ts are too effective to pass up. And across an ocean, girls in Hong Kong are at 7-Eleven, paging through beauty magazines, columns and columns of eyes, lined up on the page, available in every hue. Eye makeup tutorials, mascara, eyeliner, just make them bigger. It's beyond shopping for the eyes, it's shopping for eyes. 36. What happens in Asia stays in Vegas. 21st century proverb. Now that's a lot of show. The ladyboys of Thailand dressed as Las Vegas, showgirls on the streets, showing off their top-notch surgeries, making them into complete women. They're posing with the all-knowing Asian man who revels in the show of it all. But what if? If I were that man, I'd take a ladyboy over a stripper in a heartbeat, my friend says. We're about to enter the vagina-shaped restaurant that's hosting the Ladyboy Beauty Pageant. One contestant is singing in Siamese and tight green silk, complete with dragonfly detailing, as the tourist men who have no idea flock to her. Well, what happens in Asia can really just stay the hell in Asia. And the next contestant is prepped with her all-female ripped abs, boxing in front of the vodka-hammered crowds. Thailand's Got Talent, the finale of ladyboys purring into microphones. 38. And beforehand, there's this like Brave New World reference. Though Lenina in Brave New World is the alpha female of Huxley's masterpiece, she's only in the beta cast. Again, Lenina's only in the beta cast. 38. The glamazon type A women of Hong Kong, females whose favorite position is the doggy CEO, being interviewed by an American journalist about the hierarchy. The hierarchy. It's Brave New World all over again. The alpha males are on top, the female version doesn't exist, or in this case, they can exist in the world of love. The A men want the B women, and the B men want the C women, and all you've got left over are A women and D men, and the A women will just turn the D men to ash. In other accounts, the type A women are the excess, the well-to-do women who can buy any man from the mainland, but why would they? There's still ladies who held off marriage for a job who ignore the effects of the women-to-men ratio in a peasant dress. 39. And here's a little statistic. So in 2006, the gender ratio between men and women in Hong Kong was at 1,000 females for every 912 males. This ratio is expected to decline further by the year 2036 with 1,000 females for every 763 males. What's your citizenship is the pickup line of the moment. Ivy-educated 20-something yuppies know their business, scouring Hong Kong's happy hour. They know their business, showing off their startup companies while getting their cherry on top of attraction, a hand-me-down checklist for getting women passed down to them. These boys are from the families, mothers who can tell where a woman is from based on what designers and season she's wearing. Check off American citizenship with a Hong Kong identity. Check off the 20-somethings. No leftover women. This isn't America. Check off Ivy or equivalent educated, but more checks the small noses and perfect height difference. These families are the attraction. 45. Loser back home marries Singaporean celebrity of his dreams. Blame it on the night he Googled naughty girls and found her Asia famous blog instead with 50,000 views a day. I need to have this girl. He knows his love at first screen sighting. Looking back, the viewers know it's love at first screen sighting, since these were her blog days pre-plastic surgery, pre-diet pill. He messages her a photo. In the meantime, he puts her videos on loop, letting her head go in the endless eight. She's never responded to solicitations online. She's never responded to a single message, but gives it a go and adds him on chat, letting him to have the password to her private blog, where he reads about all her sexcapades. He's had enough, saves up his money to fly her to Las Vegas for the wedding. And now I'm going to read a couple of my centerfold poems. And this is the first centerfold I wrote, centerfold of the month, Miss December. And I guess just a little background. I've always been like really fascinated and allured by Playboy since a really young age. And it all started because I was at a Perkins. And remember like those sticker machines with, where you put in like a quarter and you get a sticker? Yeah, there's like a Playboy Bunny one, but I didn't know what that was at the time. But I thought it was a very, very like iconic and like beautiful image. And I asked my mom for like 25 cents and she 50 cents and she wouldn't give it to me. And she was just like, oh, I think I'll just buy you something else instead. And from that moment, I was like, I wonder where that image came from. And then, like, jump ahead a few years. I've always just been fascinated with the culture of Playboy. I mean, recently, they stopped having nudes in their magazines, which was a really interesting, controversial change as well. And I think it's very, very grand. And as a woman, these issues are really, really fascinating to me. Centerfold of the month is December. I asked the photographer what a butt lamp is, and he tells me it'll light up like crack, let it glow their ass facing the ceiling, trying not to fall off the black satin sheets. They're recreating a love scene of the 1970s, round red fantasies of the mile high club in the private jet of the Playboy when I feel an itch down there. I was told by a girlfriend no furry bikinis allowed, editing has been airbrushed. It's my first photo shoot, no news before this. I'm embarrassed and admitting, and yes, I've always wanted this, and I'm convincing myself. Thinking back to when I was a little girl who made faces, trying to look like a supermodel in the bathroom mirror, and then sneaking into my father's bed, looking at his Playboy's body, mind. The makeup artist covers the bags under my eyes. I tell him how the shots just kept coming and coming and coming last night, tequila after tequila after tequila. And he tells me how the other girls probably wanted to ruin my shoot. So it's time to get territorial in the next scene when the photographer tells me to rest my butt on the round at the bottom of the staircase, body facing the camera and live my lip can-can style, but looking at him, then pretending the staircase is a man, an ex-boyfriend that loves to see everything up front in his face so he could examine everything in the light. I turn around, elongating my back, wrapping my legs around its rail, slowly turning my face around, giving a wink back to the photographer as if he's the hidden camera in the room. Ooh, that's classy. He gushes over my moon name. Ask a beautiful woman, what is love in tennis and what is love? If there's personality in the way you jump, then I wonder about how you fall down the rabbit hole into a man's magazine. Girls strip naked, rosy cheek, flushed out of virginity, blondes with double D's in their well-trimmed gardens play croquet, badminton, and tennis. The stylist wouldn't give me a blowing white skirt. I'm naked. Who plays a game without a sports bra? And what is love in tennis, or what is love anyway? My butt cheeks and arms ready to play, swinging that racket like I'm about to paddle my man in the bedroom and an air jump in white sneakers, ass facing the net, a centerfold maneuver, turning around, smiling coyly at the camera like I just spanked my man, begging for the paycheck, begging him to grab me, pinch my cheeks pink and let me be schoolgirl shy, while I reach for the paddle again, knocking hard like I'm hitting a ball across the game with no net, air jump suspended, the camera catches me. If there's a personality in how you jump, then I wonder about how you fall. Caught suspended in midair, suspended in the moment when his blue eyes are looking back at you. He's suspended in the moment, touching your hair that's too-soled across great sheets. And you're both looking good, just not camera ready. The Ballad of the Centerfold for Colleen. We're shooting a mansion fantasy, plunge, gold, monokini screams. I was the girl next door, but now I'm married. A lady with flamingos in the backyard, wisteria hanging on her home, martini in hand. My blonde is big. The photographer tells me to push the folds of my swimsuit, push them to the sides, push them so the nipples show. Naturally perky because when you're married, you serve him. Each gift equals a serve. Each gift equals a job. I can't even do the shoot sitting down. The makeup artist pokes my eye, then adds on the bronze. Sun-kissed overlooking LA, like I just sit in bed all day, all night, no action. But what if I want my luncheon raw right here on the grass? I push the folds further, straps falling down, breasts out, bend my body over, take the damn suit off. Okay. Let's go to camp on this B-movie nude. Come here, you tiger, lie on this animal rug with me. At least that's what my eyes say in the nude, the curves of my back, the curvatures, right leg over the left as I flip my body, eyes facing you at all times. Boy, gaze at me 5 minutes straight, then kiss me, wrap up against me together, light my fire, let me burn. I'm about to pounce on the tiger head on the rug, grab it by the ears, feeling those fangs as rug becomes coat on me. Don't worry, it's faux. Fill me up, you tiger. You're the kind of boy I'd make a sandwich for. As long as you eat me up before eating, as long as you eat me before eating, and why don't I play dress up for you? Make believe we're in a jungle, now I'm on all fours, pouncing on the animal rug again. Go ahead, stare at my ass. My cat-like eyes are now lit by your surprise. I turn around again for you. When it comes to my flesh, it's not just entertainment, but pleasure, erection. I stand upright and you squeeze my ass like we're on a cover of a dime novel. Think of me as some wild woman on Dinosaur Island, spears ready, breasts sticking out. Appeasing that great reptile. Domesticate him, domesticate you, don't domesticate me. Or maybe you want to rescue me from lava, play the hero as a swarm of killer hornets or killer gorillas, or killer 50-foot women come my way. You hold me in your arms, fly away off into the sunset or into outer space, and I go all vampy, planning on you until someone yells, cut. We're stuck in a compromising position because that's the beauty of it all. That's the beauty of it all. Thank you. And my final poem, straight out of a 2000s music video, Let's Play in the Car. Red heels, red car, cut off shorts, thigh focused. I raise my hands over my head, hair messed up like we just played in the car. I'm sitting down, knees bent, eyes. This isn't surrender, it's desire, straight out of a 2000s music video. Girls in their short shorts and high heels fixing combustions, holding drills, but who carries torches? I turn my body, the prized ass shot, my arch back, the terrain for toy cars and harder wheels to slide down on, or I'll take the wheel, heel stomp on the pedal, pout my lips, give you a dirty look, let my breasts peep perky as I drive. Grab my hand as I hold the stick, let me pleasure you with one hand, I won't stop. I take off the cutoffs, pull down my thong, throw it on the wheel. Pretending you're there, ready to smell my panties, ready to put them in your pocket, a treasure. I sit in the passenger seat, putting my feet up, shot, turning to my left, giving that look. I want you to carry my torch, use your other hand. Thank you.